Can we talk about who, what now?
Womb envy.
Womb envy.
Yes.
Everybody making fun of Uncle Joss when he brings up womb envy. But I still believe in it. Womb envy. It's a very simple theory, and I gave it a silly name, and that probably isn't helping anybody at all. But, good Lord, I think your phone is trying to kill me. Sorry. It seemed to me a fundamental thing that women have something that men don't, the obvious being the ability to bear children, and then the sort of the resilience to hang in as parents. There are certain stereotypes that I consider to be more or less biologically true.
Mm-hmm.
Men are kind of dim. I just felt from an early age, okay, I don't understand how anybody ever pulled off the whole idea of, you know, women are inferior. Who even decided we had to take sides? I mean, I realize that love is complicated and sex has become complicated, but it's definitely like we're all on the same team. It does take two of us. To keep the human race going, and there was this, you know, great inequity that just didn't make any sense to me. And I look back and I think, okay, this is the only difference, is that men ultimately, you know, are expendable. At the end of the day, a man can't be as sure, although babies are meant to look like them right away so that they'll be aware of their paternity, but they can't be sure that they're the father. They're certainly not that involved in the process. They're not a part of something that is greater than themselves. Mm-hmm. And therefore they get all up in themselves, and therefore they not only don't get what's important about what women are capable of, but they in fact fear it and envy it and want to throw stones at it because, you know, it's the thing they can't have. So you structure a society, which, as I understand it, used to be matriarchal. You structure a society wherein you just make everything about the woman and the birthing process and everything about her body something to, you know, be spat on, basically, something useless. You just say, our stuff is better, because you can never have what they have. So you take everything else. I just believe that I can't think of any single theory that makes more sense than that to me about how humans are and how we could get to this unbelievably, completely untenable state of inequality throughout the world, in every culture.
This bleeds to the elections a little bit, because there's been this sort of competition of who suffered more, the black man or the white woman. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm going to go with the black woman and just play it safe. Transgendered agents.
You
don't calculate that. It is beside the point. I'm not going to take sides in that. I couldn't. I am neither.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that when I was in college, my then-girlfriend Jillian said something that I never forgot. When I was mourning Orson Welles, who had just died, the way I did most things in college, with tequila. And I was getting all sad and sloppy about, you know, how this great genius had been trodden down, not, you know, and had shown such promise and then not allowed to speak. And she said, yeah, that's really interesting. I feel that way about the entire history of my gender. And it really put things in perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because again, every culture, practically, every certainly big culture in the world, is doing the same thing. That is not to in any way denigrate what African Americans have gone through, particularly in America. Oppression is oppression. It doesn't matter who suffered more. What matters is that they're both part and parcel. They're both attacking the other. So, you know, it would be great if everybody banded together and you know, and linked arms, and all the oppressed came together, but we know that's not the case. And I think, you know, gay people know that's not the case particularly. I just think at this point you just move forward.
On that topic, what kind of fallout, if any, have you gotten from having Buffy have an affair with a woman in your comic?
I've gotten no fallout of any kind. You know, now that it's also because I don't have anywhere for people to reach me. But people may be up in arms. But no, you know, the fact of the matter is, it's kind of old news. It's even old news in pop culture. I think, you know, we tried not to turn it into a giant event and spend months going, wait for the Buffy kiss so she can figure out how heterosexual she is. But the same way with Willow and Tara, but it just seemed like a natural course of events that we could have some fun with. Mm-hmm. And nobody has really blinked or said boo.
You've moved possibly more than any other director I can think of across media. So you've got... correct me if I'm missing anything here. We've got a series being continued in comic books.
Continuified.
In comic books, and then you've got the blog-a-log coming on web, and then you've got television, and then you've got the movie that came from the TV show, and then the comic book that's being continued with prequels for the TV show. And mm-hmm. How much does this help you in terms of having controls over telling the stories that you want to tell by moving across media? And what changes?
Ultimately, moving across media is just about being able to tell more of the stories. Since I started telling stories myself, I've had extraordinarily uncommon luck in being able to tell them the way I want to tell them, mm-hmm. partially because I was on the tiny weblets that no longer exist. They let me do things my own way. Before that, I had been in television briefly at a lower level, and I had been in movies for a while as a script doctor, telling other people's stories and getting beaten down by the process. Buffy on TV was the first time I ever really got to put something forward myself. And from the moment that happened, they have let me, with little or no interference, tell it the way that I want to. Part of that has to do with the fact that I very much respect the rules of TV, the rules of audience engagement, the rules of keeping things commercial and interesting and, you know, poppy and fun.
Give me some example of those rules.
Well, you know, I had monsters. My cast was not hideous to look upon. You know, I made every act break an exciting time that would make you want to come back after you examined these products that we used to examine before TiVo. And, you know, I respect television in a way that some people who came out of film might not. I think I just understand the differences between the mediums pretty well. And I try to make money for the people that I work with, like Hyman Roth. And I believe that if you keep that in mind, if you understand that you're collaborating with someone who has an agenda that is not yours, you can protect your own agenda without... I had a very good relationship with the standards and practices person at the WB. You know, it was always back and forth. It was never the hell with you. I'm proud of that. I worked hard at that so that I would be able to tell stories that were largely pornographic and deeply disturbing. Part of it is that I've just been very lucky, and part of it is that I've worked hard to be, as much as I could, a company man, which is how I always wanted to be at work. I wanted to work in the studio system. The studio system began to collapse when I arrived, so I didn't really get to fulfill that dream, and I probably will end up being more of an indie guy than I had originally intended. But I do, you know, I do think beyond respecting what they want to do, I've always known what I want to do. And it did start out as just simple yarn spinning. It started out as, you know, what's a fun story to tell, and then it became, well, how does the audience relate to that story? And that really started with Alien Resurrection, mm-hmm. where I was like, okay, I got to bring Ripley back from the dead. How do I make the audience buy that? Well, they're not going to buy it, so I'm not going to make Ripley buy it. Because if they're weirded out by the concept, she has to be weirded out by the concept. And then I got into the whole metaphor of, well, she doesn't feel quite human. And then there's this robot, and she doesn't feel quite human. And then I have Winona Ryder saying, look at me, I'm disgusting. And all of a sudden, everything clicks. All of a sudden, the metaphor is there. I understand. I'm talking about human angst. It's not just about spinning yarns, and nothing is the same after that. And that was right before I started the Buffy show. Mm-hmm. and The Buffy Show. Sounds like I sound like I'm 75. Thanks for having me, Joe Franklin. So I just, you know, I knew I just wanted to talk about what people are and how painful it is. And a lot of that pain is whiny self-pity, but it's whiny self-pity that's universal. Mm-hmm. And everybody related to it as I got further into it and more into the mindset of the people who were causing the pain, like Angelus. I realized, oh, there's this side of me. Like, I discovered a lot of really unpretty things about myself as a person while I was writing, and I was excited by every one of them, because they just they showed me that it's all there, it's all inside us. And so the more I wrote, the creepier I got, and the further into real human pain I got, and the metaphor just kept deepening and deepening until I had to make sure that I, you know, do a spot check and make sure that I was still telling a story and not just sitting around talking about the pain that interests me.
Well, part of, you know, bringing Angelus, because Angelus at some points was a villain in Buffy, at least, but then the killer villains in both Angel and Firefly were these big sort of conglomerates. You've got the evil law firm in Wolfram and Hart,
right.
And you've got the Alliance in Firefly, and they're just these sort of big, vague things that look not unlike our own villains. They say that you need a really good villain in general. Can you talk a little bit about what gave you the idea of a law firm, an evil law firm?
Evil law firm was simply about, I didn't want to go Nemesis. I didn't want to create the master for Angel. I thought it would be much more useful and interesting for him to be fighting what we're all fighting, which is, you know, the sort of the punches that come from out of the blue. You know, evil doesn't come in breathing and tell you it's its father. It's your father, rather. It generally speaking, is a lot more nebulous. It, in fact, usually isn't evil so much as just a lot of people overthinking things until you find yourself caught in an untenable situation.
Which is the Alliance, sort of a benign neglect combined.
Yeah,
with,
I mean, yeah. The Alliance, I've always said, you know, I could not sit at table with Malcolm Reynolds. We wouldn't agree on a thing. I'm an Alliance Planet guy. I mean, the Alliance is America in its greatest sense, and then it's also America in Iraq. It's America in Vietnam. And the problem is, you know, it's fine over here. We're tolerant. We're evolved. We're great. But we expect everybody to have the same values, and so we're just going to ride over there and assume that they'll be happy once we destroy their infrastructure, and then just sort of our values will just somehow work when we haven't really thought it through. And that is what makes the Alliance an actual evil. But I never thought of it as evil in the same way as Wolfram and Hart. Wolfram and Hart was out to get ya.
Right.
Like, they worked for the bad guys. The Alliance was just overstepping. They were doing what any power does sooner or later. It's more or less the same with artists. As soon as they actually get the power they need to tell their stories, they go mad and start telling them really badly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I was just thinking when you talked about yourself as the company man working with, I was thinking about Angel taking the job at Wolfram and Hart, and then in the end he just lost
it
and brought down the house.
Well, I'm sure that I'm going to bring down News Corp with Dollhouse. Maybe you shouldn't quote that. No, I have a very complicated relationship that is actually very simple for me on a day-to-day basis with my work, because, yes, here I am at News Corp, and, you know, I'm not a huge fan of Mr. Murdoch's politics, God knows, or his methods, but I've been at Fox for most of my career, even before The Buffy Show, before Alien Resurrection. I had a movie here that I wrote, you know, in development. I've been at Fox for on and off for practically the whole of my career. And sometimes I go, okay, News Corp, I've been fighting them in the strike. I've been, you know, disheartened by, I was driven out of television by the people they had working here a few years back. Here I am again, and am I the biggest hypocrite in the world for taking their money? I did do an interview with one magazine that said, oh, he's so insidious, you know, he's brilliant, you know. But, you know, the question is, am I actually doing anything any good, or am I actually working for Wolfram and Hart?
No.
And I think at the end of the day, I feel like, okay, I'm doing some good. I'm doing okay. You know, they are letting me tell my stories. We'll see if the stories we tell on Dollhouse actually come out the way I plan them to, if they've got edge and integrity.
In what ways did making vampire stories or cowboy stories free you up to tell the stories you wanted to tell?
Well, I mean, it started out, you know, very simply emotionally, it started out, we can talk about what it's like to be dumped by your boyfriend right after you sleep with him, but we can do it on a much more dramatic scale, and it will resonate in a way that it wouldn't if we were just making another teen show. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, politics come into it, but ultimately, on a show like that, they will work or they won't work. You know, we did an episode about FGM on Angel, and it didn't really register. Female genital mutilation.
Oh, she.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Episode 13 of season one. You know, the episode was ultimately weak because what happens when you take something that you're interested in dealing with, and that is very much about taking women's power.
Right.
The power to own their own sexuality. I mean, it's absolutely right there in front of you. But putting it in the realm of fantasy, in that case, just kind of softened it to the point of non-existence. And it wasn't what the episode was about, mm-hmm. because it hadn't happened to her. And this was something we'd run into a lot of times. We'd find something that was interesting to us, but it wasn't where the emotional hook of the episode was, so ultimately it wasn't interesting to the audience. Same thing happened on X-Men, when I was writing the comic book Astonishing X-Men, and I became fascinated by the Danger Room, becoming self-aware, and none of my readers did. Because ultimately, it wasn't where they were invested emotionally. So, politics, in that sense, you know, genre gives you the opportunity to talk about politics in a nonpartisan way, in a way that separates itself from your regular day-to-day life just enough so that you can really engage, maybe even really think about things in a more textured way. But a show like Battlestar is political. And it's political in the best sense because they have the best metaphor possible, which is there are only 50,000 people in the world. So every decision you make, you can see the ripple effect. Mm-hmm. It happens in front of you. It's not billions. No other show I know quite has that. And we didn't have that on Angel. And so with Dollhouse, when we try to get political, it'll be more about, well, what is she passionate about, and, you know, and what world is she living in, and then, you know, we'll look at some stuff. But, I mean, you look at a lot of TV shows can bring up, you know, for example, human trafficking, which is one of the things that we wanted to deal with. Obviously, I know a lot of people on from Equality Now, because I've been involved with them for a while, and human trafficking and sex tours and things like that is one of their major causes, and a place where they've really made some inroads and actually gotten some work done. And I went to them and pitched them Dollhouse. And
how did you describe it in the initial pitch?
I described it, you know, pretty much the way I described it to Fox, except I also explained some of the episodes and about, you know, the things that we want from these fantasy engagements, and how, you know, the things that we might be considered kind of secretive and even grotesque about people are actually kind of what's beautiful about them. Mm-hmm. I think people's perversions, like their obsessions, are the things that make them interesting and worthy, like the imperfection that makes a face go from plastic to actually beautiful. And at the same time, I think a lot of the things we take for granted are as, you know, necessarily noble, are like love, are, you know, often very selfish and manipulated and socialized and not at all what we've been led to believe they are. And
as a father, now that you've got two kids, a boy and a girl, what do you think about the fact that Pixar hasn't had a female protagonist yet? Is that something that you see? I mean, when you look at the shows that your children watch.
I worked for Pixar, obviously. I wrote Toy Story. Mm-hmm. And I remember at that time having a crisis in myself because I couldn't figure out Bo Peep. And I was like, do I really know how to write women, or am I just writing, you know, stereotypes and idealized versions, or is the problem that I don't have stereotypes to work off of? Like, I couldn't figure out why I had so much trouble with that character. They're a fine bunch of guys. Mm-hmm. They do not have an agenda the way I have an agenda. So I don't, you know, I mean, I don't really look at it that hard. I mean, there's The Incredibles and there's Toy Story 2, and those both have pretty strong characters. But no, they haven't had a female lead.
No, they just have, and then there's the rats are all boys. The rat chef is a boy. The robot's a boy. The girl, the only girl in the rat movie, is an unimaginative artist who just follows orders and is kind of a bitch for the first half of the movie.
You know,
I think about this because I think of my sister in particular, little girls in general.
You know, obviously I think about this all the time, and you know, I sit through every movie. I sit through, you know, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe going. So that's when she shoots the arrow. They gave her a bow and arrow, and that's how they pay it off. I sat through, you know, when at the end of Back to the Future, I was like, but they bring the girlfriend. Mm-hmm. This is a big thing. And then the first thing they do in the sequel is get rid of the girlfriend. And I'm just like, I just keep taking it on the chin. They keep setting me up and knocking me down. So you just got to, you know, but you can't expect other people necessarily to have the same agenda and to have the same priorities.
There's a market, right?
There's no reason why there couldn't be. I mean, there's that moment in The Incredibles when the mom has a pep talk with Violet, and Violet stands up like a hero, and you see her other eye for the first time. And Kai went, "Oh, look, they wrote a scene for you," because it's
right. Yeah.
Excuse me. It's such my fodder, and that's something again, if we're going to talk about, you know, enlightened activism. Being, you know, the way to deal with things in storytelling, I can't just sit around and bemoan the lack. You go and you create them. Mm-hmm. When Buffy started, there were not a lot of genre shows that could be anchored by a woman. They just didn't think that way. Mm-hmm. I had to use a joke to get in the club. I had to use, she's Buffy and she's a vampire slayer. It's funny. And it was. It's
but
a charming little notion.
Were you actively saying, I am going to make a woman that rocks and she's going to be a feminist icon, or were you just mm-hmm. sort of intuitively following, telling the story you want to tell? Because, or
well,
are they the same?
It's both. It's both. And they're not the same. Because intuitively means this is what turns me on. This is what I need to see. This is what I long for. This is my obsession. This is my perversion. Mm-hmm. I am going to have the agenda to do this is a different thing. I've seen a lot of movies by guys who set out to do that very thing who didn't feel it. Look at A League of Their Own.
Yeah.
Well, you know, all of the good lines are
sold.
Tom Hanks's.
Right.
You know, those guys, you know, are really fabulous writers. Parenthood is an amazing film, but it's all about fathers.
No, it's not about whether or not the woman happens to be able to shoot a gun really well. It's about whether or not she has an arc and whether or not she gets to be funny.
Yeah, so I saw Tasha Yar on the first episode of Star Trek The Next Generation as the security officer. I was like, well, hot damn. Mm. I'm into this chick. Episode 2, she's having sex with the love bot. Episode 2, everybody goes crazy and she has sex with the robot. And mm-hmm. and I'm just like, oh, okay, but she's still the security officer. And she was dead within a year. It they set you up and then they knock you down. But the point is, it's not enough to say, oh, this should be done. You have to need to do it. You know, it's like Guillermo del Toro needs to make movies about insects. That man cares more about insects than anybody else I know. Mm-hmm. I mean, he used an insect metaphor for the resurrection in Kronos, for the love of God. But I respect that.
Right.
That's his thing. He clearly is obsessed. And obsession is beautiful. It's what makes art. You know, I'll forgive any fault if I believe the people who are making the thing care about the thing they're making, mm-hmm. care about the story they're telling. I will not forgive any fault if I think they're being disingenuous. Sometimes it's less disingenuous and more just the incoherent text of people who want to say one thing but only know the structure to say another. Boy, I've been seeing a lot of that in Cold Case, which, because we watch a lot of procedurals I've been watching, and it's a relentlessly liberal. They do stories about, race relations and gay rights and feminism, and they're constantly, like, and they do torture porn. Mm-hmm. Real torture porn, like, hard to watch, including a girl being stoned to death, that just goes on and on. And it's like, they're probably all, you know, good, sweet people. I know that they're, you know, the stories they tell, the characters are sweet, they're trying to be redemptive, but at the same time they're showing me something I can't sit through.
But you have, everything that you do is stylized violence. People are getting killed all the time,
yes.
Bad guys are getting killed all the time. how does that work in your mind when you compare that to very, very explicit violence, either that's either mental or physical?
Well, you know, I've said, in fact, I said it last night after watching what will be my last episode of Cold Case. You know, this is why Buffy was never scary, because I don't like to kill people.
Uh-huh.
My problem with horror movies is that I don't think people are expendable, and that makes it very tricky. And here's an example of working for Wolfram and Hart. When I did Firefly, one of the things that was going to be a part of the show is that shooting people was... even though this was a Western, this was not something that happened off the cuff. It was more, you know, a serious and often disastrous choice. But the mandate came down, you must have more action. You must be more cavalier and light and have more action. And so I, you know, took a step back and said, all right, Mal's going to shoot some guys. He's going to throw a guy into the engine. He's going to kick him into the engine, and that's going to be funny. Because, you know, it never became offensive because I don't dwell on the violence, and I still, you know, it still has consequences, but, and I do try to make it look painful,
mm-hmm.
Which I think helps, mm-hmm. But ultimately, you know, I'm, you know, from the very start, I had a girl who was going to be stabbing people as a role model, and, a lot of that has to do with my own, you know, what a lot of us use that for. It's sort of that pent up, I want to beat up a bully. Like that little guy rage that everybody feels at some point, except for very large, even including very large bullies, I think.
Yeah.
And you can't get away from the fact that action is exciting and that, you know, people like the stakes to be high, and so you get into gunplay and violence and whatnot, and you just have to figure out where the line is, and you have to keep checking to make sure if you're anywhere near it. But other people don't have that problem. Other people like, you know, buckets of blood, and other people like gore, and, you know, and a lot of the movies that I adored and that shaped me were, you know, terribly gory, and, you know, the 70s horror movies and stuff like that. Yet, I learned a lot from them. I mean, the Romero trilogy is still one of the most important, you know, bodies of filmmaking in my sort of education, but I don't have people's innards being ripped out quite as often. Well, I mean, violence is how our history began.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's how we define ourselves, and we're not the only culture that does that, but the American mythos is based in violence, and anybody who knows how much Slotkin I'm always preaching knows that regeneration through violence is the first myth.
Can we go back to when you said that being a company man and having different limitations that you have to work with for television?
Mm-hmm.
There are different limitations for film. I mean, I remember at one point the difference between a film having to end on an answer,
mm-hmm.
while a television series
yes.
can always end on a question, which may lead for more explorations of moral ambiguity as a possibility on television than elsewhere. Or with comic books, what's it like writing? What's the difference between writing Buffy? Producing, creating Buffy for season 8 in terms of what you can and can't do versus doing it for television for so many years?
Honestly, it's really just Buffy, but slightly less.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can do anything we want in terms of scope, but we can't do anything we want in terms of how we treat the characters. And, you know, the integrity of the characters is ultimately what people are most interested in preserving and what they will attack me about if they think it's not working. When I did the first 4 issues, it was kind of a sort of here we all are gay romp, like every first episode of the season, usually the weakest, because it didn't come off a cliffhanger. It was just kind of like, and here we are. And then as you get further in, you know, the relationships start to blossom and you start to remember how complex these characters are. Ultimately, though, it's just, you know, I don't have to do as much of it. And every story, you know, it's 4 issues is almost like 4 acts of a show, a huge one. But,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's really different. So you're taking 4 months to tell something instead of an hour. So ultimately, the responsibilities are the same. The difference really is with movies and TV. That's where I really felt it, and I felt it making Serenity after Firefly, because you could have no better lesson in the difference than making a movie of your own TV show. And I, you know, I also described them, and again, some people might take this as stereotyping, but I described, you know, television as feminine and movies as masculine, in the sense that television wants to examine a problem from all sides and talk about it for a long time, and movies just want to get to the point and then leave.
So then what?
They just want to hit the climax and maybe have a smoke.
What's a comic book, then?
A comic book is really... You know, gosh, I'm not even sure I can say, because I don't think of it as those things. I learned an enormous amount visually and structurally about storytelling and obviously about the kind of stories I want to tell from comics, particularly Marvel comics. At the same time, you know, they're really their own thing. They have their own rhythm and their own mythos. The opportunities ultimately are the same. Mm-hmm. In all three, the opportunity is to find the moment, and the moment is, you know, the moment is Angel pretending that he's not evil, he just didn't enjoy sleeping with Buffy. The moment is Colossus running through Kitty. The moment is River standing there with her blades and a bunch of Reavers. It's no matter what medium you're going for, it's the moment. It could be visual, it could be emotional, it's usually both if you're doing your job right. And that's the thing upon which everything I do is based, that moment that makes you go, oh, damn, yeah.
Do you have an image of the moment before you start to work that
usually,
catches you,
usually
you right around it?
Yeah, that's the thing you're going for. It might change, you might have some you throw out. I mean, obviously it's not cut and dried, but yeah, the moment is the thing. The moment is I mean, the journey, the whole thing, is what people hopefully are there for, but they are there because in that journey there will be those moments when he sticks a blade in Buffy's face and says, "What do you have left?" And she grabs it and says, "Me."
Okay, can I ask you the straight question? It again goes back to Angel.
Yeah.
He went out in a blaze of glory. He was mm-hmm. able to hurt them for one shining moment, but power endured. When you look at the writer's strike now that you're back, how do you feel about how it went down?
I feel about it the way I felt about it the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Never really changed. I mean, I had fluctuations and ups and downs just like everybody else, but it was very clear that the studios caused the strike very deliberately because they had a particular agenda, one of which, the more far-reaching, I think, was to break the union, because anytime they can do that, they are going to.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime they can create a situation where there are wage slaves and there are magnates and there is nobody in between, that's what they're going to do. Anytime they can break down the middle class and not have to deal with it, that's what they're going to do. The more definite agenda was to give themselves a little breathing room because the mediums are restructuring themselves, and they wanted to do a little restructuring of their own, clean house, and get ready for what is going to be the next era. So this allowed them to, you know, to cut away a lot of deals, cut away a lot of the fat, cut away their sort of their ties to the pilot season, as it were, and then sort of come back with a restructure now. This has worked well for me, in the sense that they don't have as many things in the hopper, and they are being very, very supportive of Dollhouse. That also has to do with the fact that smarter people have walked into the offices, and that doesn't mean that I'm all that. I don't mean that you know, you have to be smart to appreciate me or you or anything like that. I mean that these people behave differently, and they really so far have been both supportive and also intelligently critical, but what it there's also the, there's now an internet component that's part of every television show. Like, they've clearly thought ahead about what they were going to be doing when this was all over, and I do believe, in fact, that it ended on a day that they had marked in their calendars before we ever struck.
For better or for worse.
Well, ultimately, we got something out of it. You know, the AMPTP took out an incredibly whiny little notice after, when they made their deal with the DGA. They took a real dig at the WGA, and it was the only ray of hope I had in the whole thing, because I thought, well, if they're still complaining, we might actually have gotten something they didn't expect to give up. But the fact of the matter is that as soon as the Oscars became an issue and the WGA was suddenly telling us we have to have the Oscars, I mean, they had banners made up let us have the Oscars that we were supposed to be showing.
I didn't understand that as an outsider. Why?
I didn't understand that as an insider. it's an awards show. And it's all very well to say, you know, it's, I mean, obviously I don't want to hurt the community.
Right.
I understand the community was being hurt, but we were striking for something very important. And what happened was that suddenly our leadership said, it's done, we've got everything we can, we've got to have the Oscars, and the great big meeting that we went to, where I thought we were going to vote on whether to ratify, it was already a done deal. There was never any vote. I mean, that is to say there was a vote, but it was already a given. Everybody was just relieved to go back, and they had made some inroads. But nobody said, why now? You know, why, if the Oscars matter so goddamn much, then why aren't we using them as leverage instead of pretending that they matter to us? We're writers. Nobody's even, they're going to fast forward through our speech. But you know, a strike is always going to be tough. And again, to be a hardliner when things are, you know, when you know you can hold out is something that would be offensive to some people that, you know, you're fighting for. So it's tough. But it did lead to a lot more awareness of the concept of the internet as a venue. And I did lead to Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog,
which
is the finest film of our generation, and one of the shortest.
How did it feel? I mean, what was the difference about directing a show for on the web that was meant to be webcast? Did you want to do more of them afterwards? Do you see it as being a venue in which you'd like to produce? I mean, technology is... You couldn't have made Firefly when you made Buffy. The vampires looked better by the end of Buffy
no,
than at the
true.
Beginning.
Things that we could do.
Digital film. What?
Now. Were hilarious then. The fact is that, you know, Dr. Horrible isn't a bunch of special effects. It's really just a bunch of people singing with some special effects. But, and I, you know, I financed the thing myself, and it involved a lot of waivers and a lot of favors. You know, I got a lot of people that I've known to throw in and do great work for Beans because we all had the love and we wanted to do the thing. You know, that's not actually a business model. And whether or not I actually ever make any money back or get to pay my crew or any of those antiquated notions, you know, will also be interesting. But it is the finest film of our generation, so I think that, you know, that it has a shot. We're still trying to figure out how to use the internet per se to monetize the thing, and also editing it. But we do feel, you know, I feel strongly that, you know, I tried to make a big deal with people up north to create content without the studios, and was very anxious that that deal should go through. I spent a lot of time off the picket lines taking these meetings to get some content going to create jobs in the community before we came back. That deal still hasn't finished being made, so they're actually taking longer than studios. So Dr. Horrible, which was the smaller, stranger, sillier idea, I just said, you know, I have the people, I want to do this. It happened very fast and very organically, and it was insane. Again, it's not really a model because it was this bizarre labor of love. At the same time, we did make it, you know, on the cheap for the internet. It looks pretty damn good. I mean, we got a really amazing crew together.
Uh-huh.
And forget about the actors. You just wait, just wait. But it's, you know, it's the beginning of something else.
Okay.
And I'm having a wonderful time working on Dollhouse, but I got to look to the future, and, I can't self-finance an entire, you know, slew of things, but I can, you know, start the wheels turning a little bit. And I think this is going to be one of the things it does.